from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. This is Knowledge at Wharton on Business Radio. Here's your host, Dan Loney.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Knowledge at Wharton here on Sirius XM 132 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Starting out the week after Thanksgiving, November the 26th. Great having you join us wherever you're listening around the United States or up into Canada. Here's what we have for you on today's show. At the top, the latest national climate assessment was released last Friday. It shows that the concerns of climate change are growing across the country and that the health and economic impacts could be very important to note in the relatively near future. It's also in direct conflict with statements by President Trump. So what impact will this report have? Then, in about 30 minutes, air quality in California over the last couple of weeks has been some of the worst in the world due to the wildfires across the state. We'll look at the impact and what's ahead for the people living there coming up at 10:30 Eastern Time. Then, in hour number two, a Brexit agreement has been approved by the European Union. But will it be approved by the House of Commons, the British government? It's a dicey situation that may be coming to a head with a vote coming up in about 2 weeks' time on that agreement. We'll see if there's common ground or more division when we discuss that coming up at 11 Eastern Time. And then in our final 30, Wharton's Kevin Werbach joins us to discuss his new book that looks at how blockchain, a system that has had its detractors, can become a trustworthy component to our banking and business sectors. All of that over the next 2 hours. Your comments and questions are welcome throughout, and the way for you to join in is either by phone at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866, or if you can't get your phone, you can send us a comment on Twitter, at BizRadio132, or my Twitter account, which is at Dan Loney, L-O-N-E-Y, 21. First, though, here's what you need to know from today's business headlines. And it appears that Black Friday sales apparently did very well. Adobe Analytics reports that online sales on Friday were up 23.5% from last year, bringing in $6.22 billion. There was also more than $2 billion spent on smartphone sales, which was a record. Today, Cyber Monday, we'll see more shopping deals with an expectation of an 18% increase over last year to near $8 billion in sales. Individual retailer sales on Black Friday should be coming out later today or tomorrow. General Motors is expected to make a major announcement today on global operations. It's believed that its plant in Oshawa, Ontario, Canada, will be shut down at the end of 2019. Canadian TV made those reports on Sunday after comments by the union that represents most auto workers in Canada, Unifor. Campbell Soup Company is close to reaching an agreement with Daniel Loeb's Third Point on a settlement. The high-profile proxy fight would most likely add two seats to the board of directors of Campbell's for Loeb's company, as Campbell Soup is looking to rebuild its business. And many cable and satellite providers who carried the Tiger Woods-Phil Mickelson challenge match on pay-per-view on Friday will be handing out refunds to customers who bought the event because of a technical glitch in the feed from AT&T's live streaming service. People who bought the event on services like Comcast, Charter Communications, and Dish Network paid $19.99. AT&T had offered its customers the match for free after the glitch occurred. On Black Friday, while people were shopping or cleaning up from the Thanksgiving holiday, the federal government released the latest national climate assessment, and it does not look good. The report says we're already seeing the impact of climate change, including the deadly wildfires in the West and severe hurricanes that have battered eastern parts of the United States, and that such events are worsening. It also says that if nothing is done, climate change could cost the U.S. as much as $500 billion a year in crop damage, lost labor, infrastructure repairs, and housing losses, among other things, not to mention that it could lead to numerous deaths. The assessment was done by 13 federal agencies, which is also interesting to note because it is in direct conflict with the policies being brought forth by the Trump administration. With more on this, we're joined here in studio by Eric Ortz, professor of legal studies and business ethics. And also joining us on the phone is Brian Berkey, who's an assistant professor in the Wharton School Department of Legal Studies and Business Ethics, as well as philosophy here at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's also a fellow in residence at Harvard's Safra Center for Ethics. Eric, great to see you.
Good to see you again.
Thank you. Brian, great to have you back with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Dan.
Thank you. I mean, we've talked at length about many of the impacts, but putting, Brian, an economic component to this really, I think, may alert more people who are focused on the economy exclusively right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, getting some of these numbers on the kind of potential economic costs of not addressing climate change for the United States is important to the, you know, if people will kind of pay attention to this, then, you know, that may motivate more people to want to take some action. So, I mean, the report projects potentially $141 billion in costs from heat-related deaths by 2100, $118 billion from sea level rise, $32 billion from infrastructure damage, and so on. I mean, you mentioned some of the other sources of potential costs also. One interesting thing to note is that they're still projecting these costs out to 2100 or so, right? They're
right.
Predicting the extent of the cost that we might face in about 80 years, where or over the course of the next 80 years or so. But I think people often will see that date, 2100, and think, well, that's still really far into the future, and it doesn't kind of grip them the way that it might grip them to kind of see numbers on the costs that we're already facing or likely to face in 10 or 20 years. And so this is one thing to kind of keep in mind in thinking about the, you know, these numbers and the way that the report might, you know, might motivate further action.
Eric?
Yeah, well, it's another example of a report that has been given. And the truth is that we've had a lot of these reports. So that we had a UN report in October that said we really have to look at a target of 1.5 degrees centigrade as a ceiling of how far is going to be relatively safe. Now we have this report. We've been having scientific reports that we really need to think about climate change for a while. So an advantage as we're focusing on here is that it is focusing on some of the costs. You started off the news hour talking about Black Friday.
Yeah.
And it was not accidental that the administration dropped the report on a day that most people are shopping and otherwise looking at other issues, and maybe including now. So it's a holiday weekend. So I think we still have the problem. The main problem here is still how to convince people everywhere, no matter what party, what their state, what their situation is, that climate disruption is a scientifically validated problem.
Right.
The predictions are that we're going to have even more damage to the economy and to to our well-being than we have had, that we have already started to see this. And that's one, I think, sign of hope, is that people are looking at seeing the wildfires in California, the worst ever. There are predictions of similar wildfires. One already had occurred in the Southwest. It's likely to come to the Southwest. We've seen droughts. We've seen refugee flows of a relatively large nature already, and those are also going to increase. So we've seen hurricanes that have been particularly destructive and have been linked to the intensity of them have been linked to climate change. So there's a hope that you start to kind of finally people get it.
Yeah.
But what really needs to happen is that people have to believe in science again here, because if you don't really get it, one analogy I like to use is that climate disruption in the world is kind of like your own death. You do not really want to think about it because it's not very pleasant to think about the consequences, changing your business model, changing your life. But just like death, you have to think about it if you are going to care about what's going to happen after you're gone. You have to think about a death in order to write a will. You have to think about climate disruption in order to take the correct policy corrections now, or we are really this report just confirms other scientific reports that we've already had, that we are really in a civilization threatening trajectory if we don't do anything about it.
But I guess, Brian, right now, when you know that the administration, and this obviously was a report that was mandated by Congress, this all started back in around 1990 when Congress passed the bill to have this come out every 4 years, and because you know that the policies of this administration do not mesh with the reporting that is coming out, that it really becomes, I think, even more important that you have states be involved in a lot of this change, and also individual businesses as well to take these steps.
Yeah, so I think that's right. I think it's extremely unlikely, obviously, that the federal government will kind of do anything on climate in the next couple of years, at least until after the 2020 election. And so in the meantime, it's important that states, businesses, kind of local governments, individuals, you know, anyone, any entity or institution that can kind of take steps now to begin addressing these issues more seriously should be doing so. I mean, one interesting thing to note, I mean, you've brought up a couple of times the kind of disconnect between the contents of the report, its warnings, the kind of, you know, long documented kind of scientific evidence
right.
that, you know, climate change is causing all of these serious issues and the Trump administration's policies. I mean, one thing to note about this is that authors of the report who've been kind of interviewed have pretty much all said that the administration made no effort to kind of influence the content of the report or anything like this. I mean, they did, of course, release it on Black Friday
right.
To try to kind of undermine its public impact. This is in sharp contrast to what the George W. Bush administration did with these and kind of other similar reports. There were fairly systematic efforts to what we might say, you know, was water down the content, you know, limit the, you know, kind of expression of the direness of the threat. And, you know, one thing to kind of take away from this might be that unlike the Bush administration, which was sort of worried about the potential use of these reports in legal cases of the kind that are actually being brought against the government in some instances now, and you know the more general way in which policy is kind of expected to be consistent with these kind of authoritative reports, the Trump administration seems entirely unconcerned about this.
Right.
They seem to think that they will be able to simply ignore the contents of this report and that it just wasn't even worth kind of bothering to, you know, try to, you know, have any influence over its content. And, you know, this is, in a way, troubling but not surprising because it seems like what they think is that at least their base of voters is just not going to be
right.
affected by this report at all. They're not going to care. They're going to view it as, you know, not reliable, you know, junk science or whatever, you know, whatever they like to call it.
I want to get into a couple of the topics in the report itself, Brian and Eric, if we can. And one of the things that the report mentions talks about human health, safety, and quality of life that would be affected. And I think that term quality of life, Eric, I think can be a very important one when you're having this discussion moving forward, because quality of life not only talks, I think, about what you, the person right now, are going to feel, but also what your kids are going to feel or your kids' kids are going to feel down the road.
No, I think that's a really important point, Dan. It's helpful to try to get your mind around this problem by bringing it down to reality. So one way is to look at what are the actual costs within a time frame that the businesses actually have to care about it.
Right.
Another way is really to say, what does this mean to you every day? And one of the things that this report confirms is that there are you can look at the news and see this, but the fact of the increasing intensity of natural disasters, whether it's hurricanes, wildfires, drought, et cetera, are going to hit individuals, and you can see that on the news. And I think that's one possibility that people understand that, look, we either have to the best thing is to do both, to mitigate so that you can reduce this problem over time, so you have greenhouse gas coming down so these effects are going to be lessened. The other thing is to adapt, that you have to have plans in place to actually deal with the problems as they come up. So if you're going to live near the coast and you know there are going to be more intense hurricanes coming, then you have to plan to have a stronger house.
Yeah.
Right. You're gonna have if you're gonna be a city, you're gonna start to think about whether you should have housing codes that are gonna be in place to protect the people that you have responsibility to protect. Same thing with wildfire. Same thing with drought. These kinds of planning issues. The other thing is just basic health effects. If you have increased heat waves, and they document the cost of this as well, that means there are more people that are going to die from heat waves. When you have a really bad heat wave, and you're predicted to have more of them, more people are going to die in those events.
Right.
If you have droughts, the same thing. If you have worse hurricanes, same thing. So I think the extent that you can bring this issue down to the fact that it is about your own life, whether you're going to be able to have a long and happy life or not. And then if you factor this into some of the other economic conditions, so there's going to be a big impact on agriculture, for example.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's a lot of – and I think if you start to look at all the ways in which there are going to be effects on international trade because supply chains are going to be disrupted, agriculture, tourism will be disrupted. You're going to have increasing pressure from – people who are going to be fleeing the tropics if nothing is done. It's not going to be a question of 10,000 people at the southern border. It's going to be 10 million people at the southern border. And that's not going to be that's a whole different category of concern. And so I think the key also is to not scare people. So I think that's one of the mistakes that had been done maybe 20 years ago is there was a tactic that was used of, okay, let's just scare everyone with how terrible this is going to be sometime in 40, 50 years, and then everyone will agree we have to politically do something about it. That's obviously not working. It's also not working. Brian mentioned President Bush. We have a new colleague, of course, Professor Governor Jeb Bush, and I actually had a nice conversation with him at a conference we had here with the Risk Center, and he said, you know, it's also important not to start to label everybody. So we really have to reach across both sides and not call people names like, well, you're a science denier.
Okay,
if you're starting off with that, you're not going to be able to have the conversation. What we need to do is somehow come to an agreement that science is the best way to understand these issues, and then talk to each other about it. Say, okay, how can we build an understanding that science really matters and that this can be a bipartisan issue and that you can start to build a general sense that everybody has to care about this issue and then we have to do something serious about it. So I think that's at least a hope for the future is that by focusing on these everyday issues, effects on human health, effects on your everyday chances for a job and for economic viability of different kinds of businesses, that we're going to get a shift in public attitude. Because unless we get that, as Brian said, it's easy for a populist president in any country, really. Here, Brazil, same thing. You have a populist president who's going to brush this off and wants to chop down the Amazon for more cattle ranches, right? So you need to have a shift at the basic popular level of people understanding the problem so that we have bipartisan, broad solutions to the issues. And if you don't get that, so that's if we don't get that, then we are headed for some very serious problems.
Brian, the reporting also talks about infrastructure as well. And obviously, we have seen a period of time now over the last decade or so where we have seen a more focus on trying to improve the infrastructure that we have in this country. We still have a long, long way to go to be able to do that. But again, this is investment in our country that's being made, which could be impacted significantly in the next, 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, so that's right. I mean, the U.S. has done a relatively poor job for quite a while at kind of maintaining and developing infrastructure, and that applies just as much to kind of climate change preparedness as anything else. There are really significant adaptation measures that are going to be needed, in particular in certain areas like coastal areas that are going to be threatened by sea level rise. So one of the things that the report notes is that the Atlantic and Gulf coasts could see up to 5 feet of sea level rise by 2100. On the Pacific coast, a little bit less, something more in the neighborhood of 3 feet. This is going to have very significant effects on cities like Miami, Los Angeles and San Francisco in the west, cities all the way up the Atlantic and Gulf coast. New Orleans, obviously. And if we're going to be able to kind of maintain these cities and large populations in these places, we're going to have to make significant investments in infrastructure. I mean, Eric mentioned policies having to do with kind of home safety and things like this a little bit earlier. I mean, that's kind of only the beginning of what's going to need to be done. And that requires significant public investment. And of course, that is one of the many issues that has become much more politicized in recent years. We've got a lot of politicians, primarily on one side of the aisle, who are opposed to significant infrastructure investments. Now, I mean, of course, President Trump talked about investing in infrastructure during the campaign, but as far as I can tell, we're not really seeing much interest in following through on that particular intention, and in particular, not with respect to anything in the ballpark of climate change adaptation. But this is something that is going to be necessary. Otherwise, it's hard to see how we're going to be able to kind of maintain life in coastal cities and other places as well, in the way that that we have for years to this point.
Yeah, I agree with that. And just add a little bit of perspective on the two different ways that you can address climate change. So the first one is adaptation.
Yeah.
And yes, it's true that the government really should be investing some more money to help us with adaptation planning. But that's one area in which businesses, cities, individuals can make their own judgments and their own investments to adapt to what's likely to come, especially if we do nothing. Then that means the effects are going to be even higher and quicker. They're going to hit us quicker. So you need to start to think about that. The other side is a little less easy to it isn't really possible to deal with at an individual basis, and that's the mitigation problem. And that also has infrastructure implications. So the basic science now is telling us, and this is the UN report recently, and it's confirmed by this new U.S. report, that we really have to make a shift in our basic energy infrastructure in a very short time frame now. We've been sort of sitting on our hands for 15 years and not really doing anything. The Paris Agreement was a highlight, but even under the most optimistic assessments of the Paris Agreement, it really wasn't going to get us there.
Right.
And you needed to have more going forward than was there instead of rolling back. So one thing that is needed is is going to be difficult on a bipartisan basis, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has argued for a new special committee to be created in the House when it comes in that looks at what she calls a Green New Deal. Now, obviously, that's not going to bring a lot of Republicans in with that labeling. But the basic idea, I think, is correct. Mm-hmm. You need to have a Manhattan Project scale investment to really engage renewable energy and to make it realistic. So you need smart power grids. You need to boost the adoption of solar, wind, investments in new battery technologies, et cetera, in order to make this switch. And it's hard to see that that's going to be – if it's not – as was indicated earlier, it's possible that if the Republican side continues to be – refusing to do anything in this, it is feasible this could become an issue if people care about it enough, that you would have a transition in power in 2020. And then if you do planning now for a Green New Deal that will be job friendly, economy friendly, and climate friendly, then you can imagine that happening in 2020. But I think at least you got to start talking about that and really seriously thinking, okay, let's assume we can make a transition here. What actually would need to be done? What are the plans? What are the investments? Add one other point on the mitigation question. We do seem to see some coming together of agreement on both sides of the aisle on a carbon tax, right? That the basic approach that economists would recommend for mitigation is that you impose a carbon tax. Seems like there's a leading variant of that is something called a tax and dividend. So you put a tax on everyone who are just on the use of the fossil fuel intensive products, et cetera. But then there's a payback to the individuals, maybe for some other use. So you don't create a bad cycle on it. But that seems to be key. That's one key area where there does seem to be some agreement from across the aisle coming over.
Right.
And so if there's enough pressure building and enough people who are converting to the understanding the science is really telling us there's a problem, I think there's a hope for finding some agreement maybe even in the next 2 years, and then maybe definitely at 2020. In 2016, there was zero discussions of this kind of issue in the presidential campaign. I think it was noteworthy that there were zero questions about climate change in the debates. I don't think that's going to happen in 2020. So this is going to be on the agenda. There are too many disasters happening. It's affecting too many people or too many scientists and others coming forward on this. So I think it's going to be on the agenda in 2020.
Brian, are you as hopeful as Eric that maybe we will start to see some change in the next few years?
So I think it's certainly possible. I mean, I think there's a political dilemma for people who want to see significant action on climate change that comes out in some of Eric's remarks that kind of push in different directions. Right. So on the one hand, they could attempt this kind of bipartisan approach, trying to kind of bring Republicans in, maybe focusing primarily on a carbon tax and going relatively kind of non-ambitious. The worry about that is, first, it may not be enough to kind of get us where we need to go in terms of mitigation and adaptation preparedness and so on. But second, there's a kind of electoral issue, right? Young people care about climate change and, to a large extent, want to see significant action. A more bipartisan approach may not be enough to turn out a lot of young people to vote on this issue and to kind of make it a big issue within the political discussion. But then at the same time, of course, advocating more aggressive measures to address climate change, you might think, runs the risk of kind of alienating moderates, moving them toward Republicans. We just saw in Washington State in the 2018 election that voters rejected a carbon fee proposal by about 56-43. And that's notable because, Washington State isn't a place where, 56% of the population rejects climate science. It's a blue state. Population there rejected this proposed measure to contribute to addressing climate change by a fairly wide margin. So, there's a lot of people who recognize the science and I assume think that there's a serious problem, but who weren't willing to vote for what was in fact a relatively modest measure aimed at contributing to addressing the problem.
Well, then it tells you, there, Eric, that the mindset of a lot of people, and obviously a lot of people that are politicians, are ones that I think you have to question whether or not the U.S. has the willingness to make this change. And maybe it is something that will occur in the next 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it might be. But that vote alone tells you that there are still some significant issues out there.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult. And if you look at the Washington case, there was a lot, at the same time as as on your show earlier, we talked about ExxonMobil having said they're going to invest $1 million in sort of looking at carbon fees. At the same time, though, a lot of fossil fuel companies came in on the Washington vote and wanted it to be killed. So that's a question. I think in that context, it's also helpful to point out that one needs to point out, business has to take a position on this. So there are business interests on the other side of this issue that are being political.
Yeah.
So the standard argument about let's stay neutral, just let the political system work out, that's not really okay in this circumstance. It's a major issue, and the businesses that are on the other side who are in position to actually help us to solve the problem and help us to get moving forward on it have to get also political on their side, just as you have fossil fuel companies or others who might want to stop any kind of progress who are very active on the other side. So I think that's also a key for the future, is for everybody, including businesses, to get involved on the issue.
Thanks for coming in, Eric. Greatly appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Brian, great to catch up with you. Thank you again.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Brian Berkey from here at the Wharton School, and also a fellow in residence up at Harvard at the Safra Center. Eric Orts from here at the Wharton School as well. We'll take a break. When we come back, we talk about the issues surrounding air quality in the state of California, which has been have been significant because of the wildfires out there. We're going to take a look at what the impact has been in the recent time, and are there going to be lingering effects in the weeks to come? We'll do that in just a minute. Sirius XM 132, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.